This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A data dashboard that's years in the making is offering a new way of looking at Bloomington Normal.
I think we're going to see a lot of use of this data by other organizations and by entrepreneurs coming to the community.
Deanna Frouchy from the BN Advantage Data Team talks about what they'll unveil at tomorrow's BN by the Numbers event. Plus, Eric Stock reports on a proposed West Side development that could fill in a food desert. And a Central Catholic grad returns to his alma mater as part of a Carpenter's tribute performance for a good cause. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. Thanks for choosing this GLT podcast. While it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Take a moment and make a contribution to help pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org, and thanks. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The Bloomington Normal economy, its current state, and its opportunities for growth can be measured in all sorts of ways. Home sales, unemployment, income levels, the diversity of our workforce. But those data sets all live in their own worlds and rarely intersect, making it hard to see the big picture. The BN Advantage Initiative wants to bring it all together. Its new BN Vitals dashboard will debut tomorrow at the BN By the Numbers event. I spoke with two leaders from the BN Advantage data team, Country Vice President Adam Gary and retired Country Executive Deanna Frouchy, about what they see in the numbers.
And the idea of it is that this information will be helpful to other BN Advantage task forces who are looking at the economic development of our community, of Bloomington Normal, to look ahead and to say, here's what we need to do to attract new talent. Here's what we need to do to attract or build new businesses. Here's what we need to do to get the kind of people that we'd like to move to this community, who will work, who will volunteer, who will be a vital part of our community.
When you say regional dashboard, is this a website? Is this an application? How is this going to be accessed by the folks who are part of the BN Advantage team?
There's 120 or more metrics that we've collected about Bloomington, Normal, and McLean County. And those metrics are live and available on a web page that can be connected to from the regional Planning Commission website, as well as the BN Advantage website. So it is a live online dashboard. And we're also produced in the last couple of months a report that encapsulates the metrics as well as some insights or commentary about the metrics in kind of plain English, a consumable format that the various stakeholders in BN Advantage can use to understand the health of McLean County, especially Bloomington and Normal, as they're doing their work to improve all aspects of our life.
Why don't you give me an example of a couple of the metrics that are part of this collection of 100 plus on the dashboard? What are some very specific things that are being measured?
Well, on workforce, we have that broken down by the industries and types of jobs that are in McLean County, and we have showing traffic in and out of those jobs in terms of what we have in the county and in Bloomington Normal. So those are very usable stats, and not only by the BN Advantage, but we've already had interest by others since they can access the site that would like to be able to use this information and be able to have a place to go to find it.
When you think about just the quality of life in Bloomington Normal, some of the things that we're measuring include just commute times and how our commute times compare to other communities, home ownership rates, public transportation usage, and just access to parks, crime rates, other things that would help us know how we stack up compared to other communities in terms of quality of place or quality of life.
Can one of you talk about how this data existed before the BN Vitals team started to bring it together? Everybody thinks of this world of big data. There is a lot of data out there, you know, anytime you want to look for it, but it's fragmented. It's all over the place.
It was everything from this federal census data to the local municipality data, school district data, and there's, as you can imagine, all kinds of formats, all kinds of sources, all kinds of ways to interpret it. And there was really no collection of them in one place that the BN Advantage team or BN Advantage task force and other stakeholders in the community could go to and reference them. They'd have to go get them ad hoc.
We really need to give a big hand to Vasu and regional planning and her staff, because had we not had them, as I said, we started 2.5 years ago on this project, and we had no funds. No funds had been allocated to develop this dashboard. And because of various projects that Vasu and regional planning were working on, she was able to provide some staff and even a platform that we started with that we could utilize. We now have some funding to go forward with it, but had we not had that before, we wouldn't be where we are today.
So you've talked about the utility of this dashboard to other branches of BN Advantage, be it the talent and workforce folks or the quality of life team, and how it'll be used there. What about, you know, folks outside of the BN Advantage world? Is this something that, you know, somebody who's working for a company that's thinking about expanding can come in and access and look at? Is it something that academic researchers can access and pull meaningful insights out of? What about outside of the BN Advantage world?
The intention is really for it to be used very broadly.
Yes.
There's really nothing that we want to keep close to the vest. In particular, just the examples that you gave, if someone is exploring opening or expanding a business or a not-for-profit organization in the McLean County area, we now have data and information that's both current and historical about Bloomington Normal and McLean County that I think they would find very valuable in evaluating our community compared to other communities they might be considering.
I think we're going to see a lot of use of this data by other organizations and by entrepreneurs coming to the community or thinking of coming to the community and establishing a business here.
Yeah, sometimes the data is not going to tell a positive story. I mean, BN Advantage, the goal of that organization is to promote the community, but sometimes it's going to be a red number, right? So can you talk a little bit more about how you explain in the data when something is not going well and how you guys made those decisions about, you know, how to display those numbers and how to tell that story when it wasn't a good story?
Well, a lot of it just has to do with making sure the proper context is included in any given metric. If you take one metric on its own, it might tell what seems like a very negative story. And a good example that Basu has pointed out a couple of times is that poverty levels seem to be high in our community relative to other communities like ours. But as you dig down, that's largely because of the high student resident population that we have and that their incomes are so low. When it comes to census data, that reflects a poverty level that's maybe inflated because of the student population that we have here. So if you can explain the context to make sure you have an accurate understanding of an indicator that might seem unhealthy, that's the starting place. But then the organizations that are centered and organized with BN Advantage, really the impetus is let's invest in programs and initiatives and communication that would improve those indicators that we aren't trending in the way that we want them to improve. And so the more information that we know, and the more facts that we can confront, the better off we'll be long-term in Bloomington Normal and McLean County.
So as a reporter here in town, one thing I always worry about when we get, you know, monthly data from, say, the Bloomington Normal Association of Realtors or the Illinois Department of employment security. Home sales numbers, jobless rate numbers, those are kind of a monthly story that we do. And it's always an interesting thing to deal with because that data is coming from a source that has sort of a vested interest in how the data is presented, right? It behooves realtors to have positive home sales in our community. It behooves the Illinois Department of Employment Security, which is part of the governor's administration, to show positive job numbers, right? But they're the only source of data that we have. So how do you guys protect against that kind of concern? Is there any such concern as you are getting numbers from stakeholders who have a stake in how the numbers look? And how do you deal with that?
I guess two things I would say about that. One would be just complete transparency about the sources and how each indicator that's on the dashboard is sourced and displayed. And that's done through Vasu's team. Each metric you can click on it and it's gives you the data dictionary. Here's the source. Here's anything that would be selected in or out so that there's integrity from just a disclosure and transparency perspective. The other is what I would call the snicker test or the realistic test that some of our team has spent time on. And even when we've gotten like tax revenue numbers, we've had representatives from both the town of Normal and the city of Bloomington going, well, that doesn't really seem right compared to what we see internally. So there's been a lot of checking and cross-checking across the metrics and by the team, because it really wouldn't serve the community well if the metrics weren't just crisply objective and we got as close to integrity as we can. So our team really strived to make an objective, factual set of metrics and report.
And that's an evolving process with the different metrics that we get and then get analyzed and then looked at and compared. And we have a lot of good people on our team, on our subcommittee, that come from various backgrounds who can really help us with that, from city government, regional government, from the universities, other places that really are helpful in looking at the analysis and saying, yes, this looks right, or do we really need to do a deeper dive to see if these numbers are right? And you have to have some level of trust, too.
Thursday, September 27th, BN Vitals will be the centerpiece at the BN by the Numbers event that the Economic Development Council puts on every quarter. So what's going to happen at that meeting, and what do you hope that people take away from seeing this kind of big debut of BN Vitals?
We hope that they're going to think there's a lot of use that they can make out of the information that we're showing, and that they will want to use it further, that they will probably ask questions, if not there, later about what else is represented or are there other things that we're going to do with it. So we hope to get a lot of good initial feedback from that group, since they would tend to be, we think, key users of the information.
This is a launching pad for a long-term utilization of this new resource for McLean County. And I think even in that event, as Vasu, who will present some of the highlights from the metrics themselves, as she's doing that, I think there'll be a little bit of myth-buster going on. There may be some perceptions in the community, positive or negative, about the state of our community economically or from a quality of place or a competitiveness with other communities, that those myths might be a little bit busted with some of the facts and data that this resource brings forward. So some might be perfectly confirming what we already knew. Others might be completely opposed.
Well, not to steal Vasu's thunder, and Vasu being the executive director of the McLean County Regional Planning Commission, which is the lead organization in BN Advantage. Not to steal her thunder, what is a myth that you over the course of your work on this you've seen busted?
I think there that some would hold that our community is no longer growing. Our community is growing by indication of a few of our metrics that we look at. It is growing at a slower pace than it has in the past, but it continues to grow.
And it's growing in different ways. Mm-hmm. We no longer have the huge companies and probably won't in the future, like a State Farm, you know, coming to town. And, of course, people have had their eyes opened by the changes that are happening within that company itself as they look at their future and how they want to grow. And we look at here, what does that mean for us? But one of the things from the original study was that we already knew we need to be targeting entrepreneurs and we need to be targeting smaller companies because we saw those as fitting in better with the way that we could grow and probably would grow in the future. So really that was no surprise from the outset. It might have been how quickly things started changing here. Even after we looked at this and we're thinking down the road 10 years, but it's really something that I think we're going to see a lot of change in the future and even more, and we're going to see this community grow in ways that we had not anticipated and in ways that are different than they were a decade ago, definitely.
That's retired country executive Deanna Frauci, along with current country vice president Adam Gary. They're co-chairs of a BN Advantage task force that created the new BN Vitals data dashboard. That dashboard will be introduced to the community tomorrow at the sold-out BN by the Numbers event. GLT is a co-sponsor of that quarterly event. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, presenting IKEA Theater's production of Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's timeless and classic science fiction novel. Performance is Saturday, September 29th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Some West Bloomington business owners have a vision for a new centerpiece project for their neighborhood. It's an area that regional planners have defined as a food desert. Lori Bell and Arthur Haynes are leading the new West Market Street Council, which has a concept to take over a plaza where the recently closed Pop's grocery store was located. They told GLT's Eric Stock they want to add a full-service grocery store.
In my vision, what I see is something similar to the plaza where Hy-Vee is, a smaller scale, of course, but that horseshoe design with all of the different storefronts and the larger section of that plaza being a grocery store.
And Laura, you wrote in your essay, Recipe for Disaster, Food Desert in the Heartland of America, that there is this tragic irony that in an area surrounded by farm fields, that West Bloomington exists in a food desert. Once thriving part of the community, it's now a part of the city that commerce has largely forgotten. Why do you think it's been difficult to get businesses, in particular grocery stores and restaurants, to locate in these neighborhoods and be successful?
Well, there's two ironies. The one that you stated with the farm fields everywhere. So here we are in the heartland and people have no access to food. The other one, you know, specific to West Bloomington, is that West Bloomington used to have lots of grocery stores. I mean, it is the oldest, most historic part of the city. So there were corner stores everywhere. There were grocery stores everywhere. Holton Homes, the housing development, is named after a grocery store owner. Like, that's how prominent grocery people were in West Bloomington back in the day. So as the white flight happened from West Bloomington, that's when we lost the grocery stores. What makes me feel hopeful is that all these people have moved here from a lot from Chicago, but from other places too. Now, we have two ways of looking at that. We can either look at that as saying, you know, these people come, they have relatively poor economic resources. They came here for the Section 8 housing. And so that's how we end up with the mentality where we don't think about that as being a commercial neighborhood anymore. We think about it as a housing neighborhood, like that's where people live. So I think we need to start looking at the people who have more recently, in the last two decades, moved to West Bloomington as being those are the people who can help revitalize it. They're not the problem.
You have a grocery store there that closed recently in Pop's.
Just to be clear about Pop's, it did not function as a grocery store. It hasn't for many years. It was not at all a grocery store. There was no fresh food in there. There was no food.
Most of the items there were purchased at the local Walmart and then brought there, and the prices being hiked up for convenience. It was more or less a avenue for the owners to make an extra dollar off of the food that already being offered outside of the community. So you would see these owners go to Walmart and buy 15 gallons of milk for $1 a gallon and bring them back to Pops and sell them for $4 a gallon.
So you believe if there was a legitimate grocery store that operated like a grocery store and served the community's needs as a grocery store should, that it would be successful?
Yes, I do believe that. And I can support that belief off of the community assessments that have been done by myself personally through my organization, Charm Inc., and other organizations such as the West Bloomington Revitalization Project and other organizations similar to that. And some of the things that we found is these residents who live in this community, majority of them, I'd say a number that I can just throw out there and be confident with, a high 60% of the residents in that community live off a fixed income, which means every dollar that they have is rationed to get through to the next paycheck or the next whatever, however they're living or wherever their finances are coming from. And if a person has to take $5 or $10 out of that rationed fund account and put it towards a taxi cab or bus to get to the grocery store, they're putting themselves in a situation where I either have food in the refrigerator or have my lights on. So this is real life situations for people. There have been studies that have been done recently that have found that over 100 children in that neighborhood go to sleep every night, every single day, hungry, without food. And this is directly tied to the food desert.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Arthur Haynes and Lori Bell with the new West Market Street Council and their efforts to bring a redeveloped plaza to the city's west side. Now let's take a look at what it'll take to make it happen. You have indicated that Mayor Terry Renner has enthusiastically supported this project. What kind of support are you specifically seeking from the city to help move this project along?
Right now in these preliminary stages, we're looking for insight. We're looking for some of the things that we've gathered thus far are some feasibility studies that have been done by the city of Bloomington that will allow us to see the obstacles that lie ahead of us, that will allow us to navigate around these obstacles.
In terms of what's needed, I think the important thing is to go. We are starting with the West Bloomington Master Plan for the development of West Bloomington. All of that work all got done. We got together as a community and we made a whole plan. We are talking only about implementing a plan that already exists, really. We are talking about taking the corner of Market and Street and Howard, which is identified in the West Bloomington Development Master Plan as being the key commercial, district of West Bloomington. It is key to the whole development of West Bloomington. That plan is sitting there, but it's nobody's responsibility to do anything about it. So there's pictures, there's words, there's all kinds of things that go with it. There's fancy renderings of what it could be like, but it's absolutely nobody's business to do anything about it. Really, I think what we are doing is just stepping up and saying we're making it our business to take that particular development project, which is key, and we're stepping up to say we're going to be the ones to figure this out.
And of course, any kind of development is going to require cash,
a considerable
amount of it. Where do you find that? And how much are you needing?
Well, we think we probably need to start with $500,000, because we're going to have to buy that property. And
is that just to buy the property itself or to do anything?
No, that would be to buy the property and do some things. We couldn't buy the property and tear all the existing buildings down and start again, but we could buy the property and rehabilitate the existing buildings, redo the parking lot, repave the parking lot, put in planters, put in benches, put in all of the amenities that come with it. We could get everything up to health code standards. We could do all of that with $500,000. We live in a city where there are corporations who, have their homes here, who have their businesses here. And I think, it would be great if we end up being able to do business to business partnerships.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And there's big money in this town, way bigger than $500,000. And I'm hoping that some of those businesses are really going to start to see this as a business development and want to partner with us, because we do not want to be known as a charity that has got our hand out for donations. We're not interested in that.
Because if you're looking at running a business, a grocery store business, there have been some setbacks in that part of the community in recent years with Fresh Market, with Cub Foods, Kroger pulled back on an expansion. Green Top Grocery is having major financial problems. Understanding that this is a different market, different part of the community that is not being served right now, but is there enough in this community to sustain a business like that, not just to get it going, but to have a regular customer base that it can thrive and help grow that part of the community?
I think the answer to that question will ultimately serve as the business model, the way that this will come about. I think where we are right now, we'll need to gather that information to know how to scale this thing. We don't want to build some huge grocery store that's not going to be successful. I think the best way to go about this is to understand the needs of the community and then provide, fill that void from that standpoint. That way we don't get too far ahead, and that way everything that we come up with or whatever we decide to do at that location is sufficient for the needs of the people in that community.
When I've brought people who were very skeptical, I've been bringing people to Common Ground. And when people see Common Ground and they know that business has been standing there on Main Street since 1978 and it's kept its doors open while everybody else has, you know, gone through this and that, the whole downtown went, you know, has gone through all of what it's been through, and Common Ground has, you know, been successful all the way through. I think there is the way to be the right thing in the right place. That's what we need to be.
That's Lori Bell and Arthur Haynes with the West Market Street Council. They spoke with GLT's Eric Stock. They say there's no timetable for raising the money or for any store to open. This is Sound Ideas.
Public radio brings you all kinds of opinions, including those you may not share. Hi, I'm GLT Program Director Mike McCurdy. NPR and GLT specialize in breaking down complicated issues, and you count on those conversations because you know they can help you learn and think twice about your own beliefs. Tough conversations happen on NPR and GLT thanks to support from people who value honest reporting. And the opinion that matters most right now is whether you believe in financially supporting public radio. Contribute at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Children's Discovery Museum, hosting breakfast on the balcony during ISU's homecoming parade October 13th. Raffle winner will enjoy a bird's eye view for 20 people. Tickets and details available at childrensdiscoverymuseum.net. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Imagine this scene. An anthrax scare descends upon a Chicago festival with more than 100,000 people in attendance. There are festival goers from all over the state, and they bring the threat of this potentially deadly bacterial disease with them. So the governor orders emergency medications to be dispensed to all 102 counties within 24 hours. Could McLean County handle a mass distribution to its more than 170,000 residents in such a short period of time? As GLT's Eric Stock reports, health and emergency officials tried to simulate that doomsday scenario in a full-scale exercise in Normal.
Redbird Arena, one of the few places in the county large enough for a mass distribution of medications, was the test site as staff from the McLean County Health Department, Illinois State University, McLean County Emergency Management, the Normal Fire Department, and more than 100 volunteers simulated how they could dispense medications to thousands of people and, when necessary, check them for potential anthrax exposure. One of the volunteers was Jenny Riggins of Normal. It's an exercise of particular interest to her. As a retiree of ISU's Student Health Services, Riggins says she was impressed with how well the event was organized, but noticed some potential problem spots. In one instance, she played a mom with two young children.
they didn't offer me any particular accommodation. So I had to fill out information on a clipboard, and I probably have this four-month-old on the front of me in a pack, and I maybe have the two-year-old in a stroller. I'm thinking that would have been quite challenging.
Reagan's adds parents might have been expecting liquid medications for their young children. That, she says, would have created another obstacle.
There were instructions, very detailed instructions, that you have to smash up the pills, combine them with water, figure out how much dose to give. That would be a challenge to the modern parent because they would have never done that.
McCartney Britton from Colchester decided to take part in the exercise as he is studying emergency management at Western Illinois University. We joined Britton for a walkthrough as he tried to get life-saving meds for himself and his neighbor.
Right now we're filling out, it's basically who you are, and what members are, like, if you're picking up for your family, like right now the actor that I'm playing, I'm picking up for my homebound neighbor. So I got to put his name and his information on this sheet too and see if they'll dispense for me or not. And then basically it's also, do I have any allergies to any of the medication that they're going to be dispensing for the anthrax exposure.
What followed for Britton was a maze of confusion and sometimes conflicting messages. It required patience and persistence.
I'll be able to pick up for my neighbor today. I don't actually have his information, but he's homebound, so he's actually not able to make it to the pod.
I believe we need to know at least if he's allergic, so we know what kind of medicine to give him. Do you have that information?
Nope, I just have her name, age, and weight. She's 90 years old, so she can't get out very well.
Well, we can mark a question mark, and you can ask the nurses. We'll go ahead and fill out her information as much as you know.
Was it relatively painless?
That one was actually a little bit more difficult when you're picking up for somebody that's not your immediate family, and you don't have all the information that they're going to need, whether or not, you know, if she's allergic to the medication or not.
You didn't get a definitive answer.
I did not, so hopefully we'll talk to the nurses and see what they say.
When you're all complete here, I would like for you to go down. There's a medical examinations table. Go down and talk to them about your symptoms, but also explain to them Sherry's needs as well.
Okay.
So were you able to get the medications for your neighbor?
No, not at this time. I have to go speak with the medical evaluation team, talk about my symptoms, and then explain Sherry's needs and why she can't be here. And hopefully we get a good answer.
So you still have to sell it?
Yep, still have to sell it.
Hi.
Hello. I'm sent over here to talk to you about my symptoms. I've got swollen lymph nodes. I've been sore throat, coughing, feeling tired for the last 2 days. And I'm also need to talk to you guys about picking up for my neighbor, Sherry Wright. She's homebound. She's 90. And so she can't make it here to get the medication.
Okay. Can I take a look at what you got so far?
Yep.
You don't have a form filled out for Sherry.
Didn't give me one. The last lady at the nurse's station, she took the address form and all that with her on there.
I think you need to go back to the line at the beginning because I need to have a form on Sherry.
Sherry was on my last form. Like I said, the nurse just took it when she gave me my Cipro and then said I needed to come talk to you guys about Sherry's meds.
Okay. Do you know, is Sherry allergic to doxycycline?
I'm not sure of her allergies.
Okay. Does she have any medical conditions that you're aware of?
She's just homebound due to her age.
Okay.
She's 90.
All right. So Sherry's going to get doxycycline. It's going to be one tablet of a mouth every 12 hours as directed.
So you got him.
I did. And, like, another thing that, you know, thank God this is a training exercise because, you know, it's just another thing that, you know, there's going to be people out there for their neighbors or, you know, elderly in nursing homes even that won't be able to come in here to the pod. And it's going to be definitely a learning experience to figure out what the correct way to do it. So I'm just glad that I was able to help Sherry today.
Those seeking medications but needed special attention, such as those with a language barrier or hearing impaired or wheelchair bound, were diverted to a special functions room. Ceci Gaspardo served as supervisor there.
What's the biggest challenge to running a
exercise like this, especially if it were to be the real thing?
The language barrier, because we would have to, we do have Spanish-speaking employee or staff, but if it were a real life and we would need a Chinese, Mandarin, Russian, Polish, any other languages, we would have to get on a phone and do a three-way call. That would take a lot longer.
How quickly would you be able to do that?
We do have a contract with an interpreter server or agency that provides interpretive of any language that we need, and we could probably get them on the phone within a minute.
What have you learned about this experience so far that's adaptable to the real thing?
That it does not always run smoothly as planned. There's always some things that can be improved.
Any examples of things that you could not have prepared for?
Actually, yes. Forms, and we're making a list of what we need. Forms not in place, pens not in place, just things that we thought the patients were going to bring with them from the first station that they were at.
So this has already been a learning experience.
Oh, yes, yes. And we're writing things down.
And that may seem somewhat trivial, but seconds matter in a situation like this.
Yes, yes, they do.
Watching this exercise unfold with the managers who will be responsible for making sure the real thing, if it's ever necessary, is carried out smoothly and efficiently. They gathered across the street from Redbird Arena inside Illinois State University's Emergency Operations Center. Eric Hodges is ISU's Director of Emergency Management.
An event like this, none of us can do on our own. We have to have partners. We have to rely on each other. And we've been planning for this for a year, and those partnerships really showed today.
Were there any light bulb moments like, yeah, we didn't think of that?
The biggest thing that I wasn't sure about is whether this regional EOC would work or not, and it did. That was specifically a question I asked, and we want to all work together now in the same physical space to try to coordinate an incident like this, should it ever take place.
What's in there physically, practically, that you're able to use?
So we do have tables that hold about 20, 25 people in the EOC. We have computing, networking, cameras, situational awareness, social media, ability to print out digital maps and so forth. All those resources that we need to be effective at coordination are all in that space, and everybody gets to use them.
And that includes McLean County Health Department Director Camille Rodriguez. She says the exercise shows how well the partner agencies work together and showed there's room for improvement.
I think there were some very obvious and logistical things that we didn't think about. Putting water at the end of the line instead of putting it at the beginning on a pretty warm day was something that we observed of ourselves. We thought, well, of course, we'll give every participant a bottle of water, but it was out in the sun and it was at the end of the line. So that sounds like a simple thing, but really important to keep people hydrated when they are likely spending a large amount of time in line. Another thing logistically, and I served as sort of the emergency operations center manager, we had issues with needing more staff, and we didn't have more staff. And so we had to adjust and mitigate that by asking some of the volunteers to kind of serve as staff. And in a real-life emergency, is that something we could do with a healthy person? Not so sure exactly, but there I'm giving you a real-life example of how we had to adjust.
One comment I heard from one of the folks that went through the line was, while they were able to get through pretty quickly, if this were a real-life emergency, Redbird Arena would be full of people. There would be thousands possibly making their way through the doors all at once as opposed to a couple of dozen. And, of course, you would have the stress of a real-life situation. How would that potentially impact that?
So the folks that I was working with in the room, leaders of the respective agencies, had those similar discussions. It's all about how we communicate to the public in getting them to the arena in sort of a sequential manner, in trying to contact certain groups of people to come first, as much as we can trying to make it organized, as well as contacting, our bus systems and other ways to get people into the arena in an orderly manner. So while in as much as we want to plan ahead and think that it would work well, we know that in a real-life situation, that Redbird Arena would be full of people, but we would make sure, and that's why we practice, that's why we have these events to make sure that we know how we can make it the most orderly for people so they get the help that they need.
I imagine all the actors were able to get to Redbird Arena on their own today. In real life, that wouldn't be the case.
That is correct. And we know that we would have to have communication with our bus systems and even with others who provide transportation to say we need help with this. And we would have that as well planned ahead. And we're discussing that in what we call a hot wash. We kind of take what we've learned and say, what are we going to need to plan for again? This is not a one and done. The exercise is really just a small part of us analyzing how we would respond in the future.
Volunteers stayed after the event to offer their feedback to managers. As volunteer Jenny Riggins noted, the feedback will make it better next time, and she hopes the exercise is never needed in real life. I'm Eric Stock.
The medications for such an event would come from a national stockpile of reserve medications at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as warehoused at undisclosed locations all over the country. They were last deployed during an anthrax scare in 2001, 1 week after the 9/11 terror attacks. This is Sound Ideas. Central Catholic grad Ryan Latham says succeeding as a session musician and on-call live performer in Nashville is all about saying yes. Latham returns to his alma mater Friday as the saxophonist in the tribute band We've Only Just Begun, Carpenters Remembered, which performs at a benefit for Faith in Action, a local nonprofit serving seniors. Latham talked via Skype with GLT's John Norton about his life in Music City. He says this band is one of many in which he performs, and despite his strong jazz background, Latham says he's picked up a few things from the music of the Carpenters.
Oh, yeah, the harmonies, these waterfall harmonies that they have, their solos. In terms of the saxophone, there's two very iconic solos, one on Wait a Minute, Mr. Postman, and the other on Rainy Days and Mondays, which I actually play note for note during the show. So putting those two iconic solos in my arsenal, in my tool bag, and getting to play those and was really... just really felt great, and just kind of expanded my, you know, vocabulary, you know, musically.
Hanging around, nothing to do but frown. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down.
So what, were you in a jazz band at Central Catholic or just...
Yeah, I started playing in jazz band, pep band. I went to ISU for 2 years and didn't really find my niche there. So after that, that's when I went to Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, and I enrolled in the jazz studies program there. Just did the whole 4-year music thing, and then I ended up graduating and staying in Nashville and working as... session player and road work and live work. And
well, let me ask you about that, Ryan. How do you transition? How do you get into the really competitive business of being a session musician in a music town like Nashville?
Well, it's constantly a work in progress. But your relationships are the most important thing you can have. You have to go out and meet people and form relationships. Otherwise, nobody's going to know you're there, and your phone won't ever ring. You can be the best player on earth, really. And if nobody knows you're around, you know, you're not going to get work. So obviously you got to know what you're doing and be good. But your relationships is the most crucial. And that's how you get into that and how you stay in it.
As a session musician, is this something you aspire to? Do you fall into it? Or is it something like, OK, I'm going to do this, but what I really want to do is my own thing?
Kind of all of that. I wouldn't classify myself as a solo artist, per se. I guess I view myself right now where I'm at is more of a side man who kind of freelances and works with a lot of different groups in a lot of different settings. Some guys aspire to do, you know, session work specifically, which session work is definitely different than live work in different ways. You're more under a microscope. Time is money, per se. When you're in the studio, things got to be happening quick and precise, and there's guys that are really, really good at that, and that's just kind of all they want to do. I can do that, no problem, but I like the live stuff too. And to be honest, I take the work, if whatever setting it's in. I don't shy away from turning a session down. I don't shy away from turning some road work down or a live performance down. When the phone rings, I always joke that I'm the yes man, you know, wherever it is. And that's also how you keep working. You know, if you say no too many times, people stop calling you. So
the voice you're hearing is Ryan Latham. He's a Central Catholic grad from 1998. He's back in town this Friday night for a benefit concert. They'll play at Central Catholic High School. We've only just begun. The Carpenters Remembered is just one of the bands he plays in. And this is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I asked you about a little bit about some of the Carpenters stuff. Have you developed a favorite song or two from their repertoire that, other than what you mentioned, that you like to play or have a new appreciation for?
Yeah, there's a great song called There's a Kind of Hush. There's a kind of hush all over the world tonight. I think that's a real fun one. I get a little sax solo at the end of that. There's some cool lines in there. I love doing, we do the back rack medley. That's a fantastic a medley that Harry Sharp, our music director, arranged. I really enjoy playing that one. It's hard to pick because they're all just feel-good songs that are just so well-crafted that it's hard to deny any of them as being better or worse, per se.
On the day that you were born, the angels got together.
I want to go back to when you were going to Middle Tennessee State, and I imagine you were in Nashville itself quite a bit, right? Going back and forth between school and Nashville?
Yeah, just going to seeing shows. And so, I would make the trek back and forth quite a bit. And then once I graduated in, I think, December of 2004, I moved officially into town, into Nashville, and I've been here ever since.
So when you're at Middle Tennessee State and you're that close to Nashville, how are they talking to you on an academic level about what you're going to be doing once you graduate and in this very difficult music business where when you're coming out of school, you're basically an independent contractor? Are they preparing you for that?
You know, that's interesting, John, because that's kind of a subject that I've talked with a lot of people about. They prepare you to obviously play and do your thing, but I will say a little bit of the whole logistics and the business side of things. It probably wasn't expounded on to me enough. I had to kind of just get a crash course in that when I got out and realized, oh, wait a minute, you know, I get 1099s. I'm not a W-2 employee. I'm my own boss. You know, you have to look at yourself as you incorporated, kind of. I always say you should have taken some business classes along with the jazz degree, because that would have maybe helped you become more of a businessman, which is what obviously this is. It's not about packing your horn up and running to a club and unpacking and playing. That's part of it, but you have to look at it as a business. Yeah, like I said, they did a little bit, but it probably could have been, I probably could have used a little bit more. I had to kind of learn the hard way and really view myself as an entity, not just some guy running around with a sax on his back. They definitely prepare you to play well, but they probably don't expound enough on the business side like I wish some music schools would.
Sure. Okay. One more question for Ryan Latham. He's a Nashville musician songwriter who was a graduate from Central Catholic High School here in Bloomington. He's coming back to town Friday night at Central Catholic in a fundraiser. We've only just begun. The Carpenters Remembered tribute band is who he is here with. And this is GLT Sound Ideas. Michelle Birding Brett is Karen Carpenter in this show. She sings Karen Carpenter's parts. And if you listen to her online, her voice, just an amazing voice, but how well she can sound just like Karen herself.
Yeah, well, Michelle is fantastic as a boss and as a front woman. She's trained in the theater and in the arts. That lends itself well to channeling Karen and being out there and doing the, you know, the recreation.
When you're performing, is it as the Carpenters or it is as a tribute and you're telling the stories of the Carpenters from a third person point of view?
Yeah, it's a really, they like to kind of brand it as the Carpenters Remembered, a recreation or a celebration of the Carpenters. She'll tell little stories to the audience, like before we start a song or something, she'll mention about maybe going to something, to California, to Downey to see something at their house or in a museum. Or here's one thing in the show she'll say is, growing up, you know, she had some siblings and Her other sister wanted to be like so-and-so, and her brother wanted to be like so-and-so, and she wanted to be nothing but Karen Carpenter. That's when she heard it from the first time. She wanted to sing like Karen, and she tells the audience that during the show. And you know, when you want to sound like somebody, you have to dive into it 100%, and she definitely has. She studied this all the way, and she really does a fantastic job bringing back to life Karen's voice.
Central Catholic grad Ryan Latham speaking with GLT's John Norton. Latham returns to Central Catholic Friday as a saxophonist in the tribute band We've Only Just Begun, Carpenters Remembered, which performs as a benefit for Faith in Action, a local nonprofit serving seniors. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas and WGLT Normal. Our website's where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories. Help today from Eric Stock and John Norton. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look for it at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This was week one of the GLT Fund Drive. Our goal is to raise $25,000 in listener support in just 7 days. We're determined to do it without interrupting programs to ask for your help. It's the kind of fundraising that respects the reasons you depend on GLT. We won't take time away from the news and conversations that are important to you. Show us this can work. Help pay for Sound Ideas and help meet the goal. Renew your support and make your first contribution now at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.